This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
I'm Alex Ritson, and on the Global News podcast, we're covering the latest in the Middle East, where Israel and Hamas have signed their ceasefire and hostage release agreement, which is due to take effect on Sunday. But until then, the war continues, with Palestinian authorities reporting at least 86 deaths from continued Israeli airstrikes on the territory since the announcement of the truce. We bring you the top stories from BBC News twice a day on weekdays and daily at weekends. Search for the Global News podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. My name is Paul Henley. Coming up on the programme today, the latest on the ceasefire in Gaza, a valuable archaeological find in Pompeii, and the response to a decision taken by the US Supreme Court to uphold a ban on TikTok.
And to the US government, I'm never forgiving you for this. And I'm never going to trust you ever again because you just, like that, took away millions of people's income and livelihood. And who does that? So I'm never trusting you ever again with anything.
Emotions are high as the app is likely to be banned in the US from Sunday, despite TikTok's CEO attending Monday's presidential inauguration. We'll have more on that later. The street parade having been cancelled now and the ceremony moved indoors because of freezing temperatures predicted for Washington on the day. We'll hear from a veteran White House correspondent about the historical precedent which led to the change of venue. First, during Donald Trump's election campaign, he claimed he could end the war in Ukraine in a single day. As his inauguration nears, the goal widens. The president-elect's envoy to Ukraine now says the war could be finished within 100 days of Mr. Trump taking office. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine began in February 2022, and 3 years on, it controls almost a fifth of its neighbor's territory, including very recent gains and including the Crimean Peninsula captured a decade ago. And if there are peace talks, few expect a return to 2014 borders now. In fact, Ukraine's President Zelensky recently made it clear that land could be given up temporarily, as he put it, in exchange for Ukraine joining NATO. Amid growing speculation that negotiations will soon happen, our senior international correspondent Orla Gerin reports from the eastern city of Pokrovsk on an increasingly dark mood in Ukraine.
We're making our way along a bumpy rural road, heading for the front line in eastern Ukraine. It's after six in the evening and it's pitch dark. We're on our way to meet troops from a Ukrainian drone unit. It's the third winter of war here, and Ukraine is facing some cold, hard truths. The Russians are still grinding forward. We're travelling with the commander. His name is Mikhailo. Did you think the war would last this long?
Honestly, no. I had hoped it would be over quickly. I volunteered in the first days of the war. I'm already tired. I've been away from my family for 3 years. The only thing that saves me is that I can video call them because I have an internet connection.
We've come inside a disused building. We're completely in darkness, apart from torchlight. And the drone is being assembled. The drone unit are working fast here. They've erected a huge antenna. It's taller than a two-story building. And they're getting ready now to send up the drone. I can hear shelling in the distance. The Russians have been pushing hard to take Pokrovsk. Ukrainian forces are just hanging on at the outskirts. Do you think there's any way to do a deal with Putin?
Maybe not. But he seems like a completely unstable person. And that's putting it very gently.
Commander Mikhailo pilots the drone into the skies. It's fully armed with an anti-tank mine. Minutes later, he drops that. It lands just wide of an underground Russian position. I'm inside a small courtroom. There's a hearing about to get underway. The defendant has just been brought in under guard. He's 24 years old and he's a deserter from the army. His name is Serhiy Hnezdilov. This is a real sign of the changing times in Ukraine. You don't see queues of young men lining the streets anymore to join up, but you do see young men in the dock accused of desertion. Serhiy is one of many. It's a huge problem for the Ukrainian military and for Ukraine's war effort. Serhiy, we're from BBC News. Yes. My name is Orla. Could I ask you, why did you leave your army unit?
I did it as a sign of protest. The authorities have, for a very long time, been promising to set time limits for military service, but they haven't done it.
What message do you want to send about the war?
We must continue to fight. We have no other choice. But soldiers are not slaves. Everyone who has spent 3 years or more on the front line deserves the right to rest.
But for many who go to fight, this is the homecoming. In a Kyiv cathedral, a familiar agony is unfolding. A war widow, Anastasia Fedchenko, mourns her husband. She sits with her hands on her stomach. Anastasia is heavily pregnant with her first child. Her husband, Andriy Kuzmenko, is in uniform in an open coffin. He was a Marine commander killed in action this month.
I am sorry my daughter will never see her father, but she will know that he was a soldier, an officer, and that her father did everything he could to save Ukraine for her. As long as Russia exists, this war will exist. I truly fear that our children will inherit this war from us.
Anastasia and many other Ukrainians believe there can be no peace with President Putin. The suffering and the sacrifice continue here. What's missing is the talk of victory.
Orla Gerin reporting from Ukraine, and I spoke to Orla a short while ago from the city of Dnipro in central Ukraine. How significant, I asked her, was the fall in morale in Ukraine?
It's very striking when you travel around the country, as we've done over the last few days, and we've been coming here since before the full-scale invasion actually began, and at that time there was tremendous unity, there was tremendous support for the war effort. Ukrainians were incredibly resilient and motivated. And I think the whole world saw that in the early months and people were very struck by it. What we have now is a very different picture. This is the third winter of the war. The country has endured very, very heavy military losses. Almost everybody you speak to knows somebody who has gone to fight and who has been killed or who has come home badly maimed, perhaps as an amputee. Many families are separated because women and children have gone to live in safety abroad. And the reality of the conflict on the ground is that the Russians have continued to take territory. It has been slow, but they have continued to move forward and Ukraine has not been able to reverse that process. So there is a real sense here of a very bleak mood.
Is the Ukrainian government doing anything positive to prevent soldiers simply burning out?
Well, they're trying to make it easier for soldiers who have left their units without permission to return. In fact, a law was introduced in November which allows for that. You can return to your unit voluntarily. You can't be penalised. You have to be put back in the position that you were in, given your weapon back and so on. And the army would claim that a large number of those who desert return voluntarily, but the scale of this is something quite staggering. According to figures from the Prosecutor General's office here in Ukraine, from the full-scale invasion in February of 2022 until now, around 100,000 criminal cases have been opened against soldiers who have left their units. So that's a massive number. We know it's having an impact on morale. There are stories that come from the battlefield of soldiers being lost because Russians are able to outflank them, because the units that are supposed to be protecting them have simply left their positions. Now, people would say, including lawyers who defend some of these men, they are exhausted, they are broken, they have had no leave, no chance to go home, no time to rest. Many of them are badly equipped and they feel that they are being left on a battlefield where they cannot win, with no hope of respite.
And what about men coming of age during this war? You mentioned that there were no longer queues to join up. What penalties do you face if you refuse the draft?
Well, if you keep dodging the draft, you can be fined and eventually you can be detained. And we know of people who have been picked up off the street and from the accounts that they have been literally taken away at gunpoint by Ukrainian forces, taken away by armed Ukrainian units and forced to join up, put into training courses, had weapons put in their hands and told that they would be sent to the front lines. Now, there is a chronic shortage of manpower here and it's having an impact on what units can do at the front lines. President Zelensky has been under pressure, particularly from the Americans, to lower the age of conscription. It has been reduced down to 25. They want him to take it down to 18. He has been resisting that. But Ukraine has to try to come up with these extra soldiers from somewhere. Now, the problem is, as reluctant soldiers have said to us, look, we've been sent off to train with men who were in their 40s and 50s, some of whom have back problems, some of whom have poor eyesight, some of whom have mental health problems, and all of whom don't want to be there. So what possible use can they be if they are eventually put in a frontline position? But Ukraine is in a very, very difficult situation. The manpower is needed. It has to try to find it from somewhere.
And the speculation about peace negotiations, what sort of signals are the Ukrainian government sending out about the incoming Trump administration, finally?
They've certainly publicly been preparing the ground for this over the last few months. There's been a shift in the rhetoric from President Zelensky, from a very clear position that he would not negotiate unless all Russian invading forces were pulled out, that he would have to get back every inch of territory. That position has softened. He has started to talk publicly about negotiations. He mentioned it in his New Year address to the Ukrainian people. He said they would have to be tough on the battlefield, but also tough at the negotiating table. And he has indicated that land, which the Russians now control, could remain with them temporarily, as he puts it, and that there would be an attempt to recover it diplomatically later. I think the reality is, he knows the writing is on the wall. President Trump is going to take a very different approach. He has made it very clear that he wants negotiations.
Ola Guerin reporting. This is NewsHour. Coming up, as the US Supreme Court upholds the country's TikTok ban, one creator on the platform gives us her reaction.
I think it's definitely something that makes me nervous. It's the closest we've been to a ban since a ban ever came in the picture 2 or 3 years ago. I've been to DC with TikTok twice now to fight the ban. And so I was always cautiously optimistic about this going the other way.
News headlines. Israel's cabinet has been meeting now for several hours as Israelis and Palestinians await its ratification of the Gaza ceasefire and hostage release deal. More in a moment. And despite months of preparation, President Trump's inauguration ceremony has been moved indoors to the capital's rotunda because of frigid conditions forecast for Monday. I'm Paul Henley. This is NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, we keep hearing that Israel is about to approve a ceasefire and hostage deal for Gaza. The country's cabinet has already been holding a long meeting. It's still going on to discuss the deal, due to take effect this weekend after its approval by the smaller security cabinet earlier. If it's approved, the agreement would halt fighting and bombing in Gaza's deadliest ever war and initiate the release of dozens of hostages. Under the deal struck by Qatar, the United States and Egypt, the ensuing weeks should also see the release of hundreds of Palestinian prisoners who are held in Israeli jails. Jonah Fisher in Jerusalem has been giving me the latest.
We are still waiting. This meeting has been going on for more than 3 hours now, and this is a broader meeting of all the ministers in Mr. Netanyahu's government. They have been discussing and getting briefings from security officials about this ceasefire agreement that was reached earlier this week. We are just waiting, really, for them to come out and say what's been agreed or not agreed. Broadly speaking, we're not expecting there to be any surprises. There was a slimmed down meeting of the security cabinet earlier today, much less ministers involved in that. That voted in favour of approving the deal. There were a couple of far-right ministers who voted against, but they simply don't have the numbers in either that cabinet or the bigger government meeting, which is happening right now, to block it. So, yes, it's taking a long time, but at the moment we don't think it's something which is going to hold this up.
But we can assume they're pretty tricky negotiations.
Well, yeah, because in part we've had these far-right parties threatening to leave the government over this. One of them, Itamar Ben-Gvir, last night did a press conference in which he said if this was approved, he would walk out. Another of the parties is also making similar noises. So it is possible that these discussions are revolving around how they might present this in order to try and make sure that Mr. Netanyahu's cabinet, his government, retains its strength and it isn't left as a minority administration at a really critical time in terms of the implementation of this deal.
Talk us through some of the possibilities for the Israeli Prime Minister now. He seems reluctant. Has he had this deal foisted upon him?
Well, what has been very interesting about this is that the deal was agreed on Wednesday night. And to be quite frank, there was a sense on that Wednesday night that Israel was sort of bounced into the announcement that the deal had been made, in part by the fact that Donald Trump started tweeting about it and claiming responsibility for it long before Israel had accepted that there was truly a deal here. I think even the day after, Israel was still saying that there were some details that hadn't been fully agreed. We haven't seen Mr. Netanyahu speak publicly to the nation about this deal yet and make the case for it. There's just been a few very limited statements come out from his office. So you can see there the uneasiness and also the difficulty, in a sense, that the difficult spot that Mr. Netanyahu is in. This is a deal that's been around for a long time, and for a long time Mr. Netanyahu's government said it wasn't a good deal. Now this is the moment. Things have obviously come together to make this happen, in part due to incoming President Donald Trump's role. And now Mr. Netanyahu is having to try and convince everyone that this is it. We need to go forward with this now. It may not be a deal that you like very much, but this is the time to do it and to bring some of the hostages home, because we have to be clear about that. It's not a deal that resolves either the key issues related to Gaza or indeed brings home all of the hostages who have been taken by Hamas.
Jonah Fisher, our correspondent in Jerusalem. For the first time in decades, the presidential inauguration in Washington will take place indoors. Because freezing weather is expected, Monday's ceremony, swearing Donald Trump into the job for the second time, will take place in the rotunda, the hall under the dome of the Capitol. It means that fewer people will be able to attend. John Gizzi is Newsmax's chief political columnist and White House correspondent and a veteran of inaugurations. I asked him when one was last held indoors.
Ronald Reagan's in 1985. I remember it very well. The president had to downsize the crowds, obviously. The six-figure crowd that usually gathers to cheer the president on was just not going to be accommodated in the U.S. Capitol. And it came down to members of Congress, of his administration, his family, and a few close personal friends like the actor Jimmy Stewart and his wife Gloria. President Reagan said at the time, it's cold outside, but we have some warm hearts in here. And he proceeded to give an address and have a small private reception afterward. Very different from all the pomp and ceremony and parades that Washingtonians are used to on January 20th.
Is there a rule if the temperature falls below a certain figure, then it has to go indoors, or is this at the request of the president-elect?
When temperatures fall to sub-zero numbers, that it becomes pretty obvious, and then the inaugural committee, the Congress, and others, usually in unison, will move the inauguration indoors. It has a very significant genesis. In 1840, William Henry Harrison, then the oldest president at 68, was sworn in outdoors. He did not wear a hat or scarf, and he proceeded to speak for more than an hour, the longest presidential address in history. Well, he caught a cold, and a month later, he was dead, the first president to die in office. This is something that the powers that be take into consideration, and it should be noted, Ronald Reagan was 73 at the start of his second term. Donald Trump is 78.
Does this mean that there won't be big crowds outside at all in Washington? Will it spoil President Trump's plans? He does like a big crowd.
He does like a big crowd, but the president is also aware that these are the rules of the game. If it gets too cold and the health of people is threatened, I'm sure he will go along and not bemoan the loss of those crowds he loves. But I would say no, he will enjoy it just being president again. And as for the crowds, well, he can just have another rally and lead them in the Trump dance.
JFK was inaugurated in very cold weather, wasn't he?
He certainly was. And a number of his invited guests, including former President Herbert Hoover, had to beg off because of the cold. The new president himself wore thermal underwear the day he delivered his inaugural address. And according to his younger brother, Senator Ted Kennedy, their father was coming in a limousine, and he was driving in Washington, and the snow kept coming onto the windshield to where the chauffeur pulled over. Well, Joseph Kennedy, former ambassador to the court of St. James, in formal clothes, stepped out, grabbed a scraper, and brushed off all of the snow. And as Ted Kennedy said, nothing was going to stop him from seeing his son become president.
There's going to have to be a big organizational rethink in a hurry. No parade, for example.
And it's not just no parades. I did a stand-up in front of the Capitol on Wednesday, and I saw all of those chairs that were out there. And I saw all of the standing room for people. And certainly it will be a change. That said, people who've flown from outside the country, all over the United States, they're going to dare the cold and just walk and say, I was there.
John Gizzi, White House correspondent for Newsmax. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're live from London. Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, as the population of Uganda's capital city, Kampala, continues to grow, so does pressure on public services, including waste management. The city's only major dump site is running out of space, and with Kampala producing an estimated 2,000 tons of waste every day, a mountain of rubbish is at risk of collapsing again, as it did in August 2024, killing more than 30 people. The BBC's Agnes Pender meets volunteers cleaning up Kampala.
Once a month, a group of around a dozen volunteers get together in Uganda's capital, Kampala, with one goal: to clean their city. 31-year-old Abel Odeke started the Equal Aqua Uganda group in 2020 because he felt a lot more could be done to manage Kampala's waste.
Actually, we have a very big problem in Kampala with waste management, because we really realize that there is no proper system where we separate the plastic from the food materials and from the metallic kind of stuff.
Kampala generates around 2,000 tons of waste every day. City authorities allow private companies to collect the waste, but there are no wide-scale recycling or incineration systems. Kampala's population is growing at a rapid rate of 4% per year, according to the latest national census. And the city's public services are under pressure. Kitezi is one of Uganda's largest dump sites, situated in Kampala. This 15-hectare wasteland is the final destination for the dump trucks operating across Kampala's 7 waste collection zones. Informal workers sift through garbage to find items that can be cleaned and resold. In August 2024, a large section of it collapsed, killing more than 30 people and burying several homes underneath. Okuku survived.
We saw the thing starting to move. I was very quick. I ran away. I ran from the side that was not falling. And maybe the unlucky people on that day, I think, didn't survive the tragedy.
The dump site has been expanding since it was established in 1996. Surrounded by settlements, the dump site has no more space to expand, except upwards. Throughout the day, dump trucks arrive and pile on the trash wherever they find space.
So that is not a right thing. You pile and pile and pile and pile. No, that is not right.
Urban planner Frank Muramuzi says this is a serious problem.
You cannot get the 4 million people and you go and get all that waste and you take them to one dumping site. No, that's not how we do it.
Urban planner Frank Muramuzi ending that report by the BBC's Agnes Pender. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. Now, after a lot of speculation that a reprieve could be in the offing, the US Supreme Court has now rejected an appeal by TikTok. It means that one of the world's biggest social media platforms will be banned in the US from Sunday. For many of the users of the platform, emotions are running high.
And to the US government, I'm never forgiving you for this. And I'm never going to trust you ever again, because you just, like that, took away millions of people's income and livelihood. And who does that? So I'm never trusting you ever again with anything.
The fight by TikTok does not seem to be over yet, though. In a video posted today, the boss of the company thanked President-elect Trump for his about turn on the subject and his recent personal pledge to stop the ban.
We have been fighting to protect the constitutional right to free speech for the more than 170 million Americans who use our platform every day to connect, create, discover, and achieve their dreams. On behalf of everyone at TikTok and all our users across the country, I want to thank President Trump for his commitment to work with us to find a solution that keeps TikTok available in the United States.
The TikTok CEO is, in fact, due to be one of the guests at the presidential inauguration in Washington on Monday. TikTok has 170 million users across North America. Congress passed a law last year saying the Chinese-owned platform posed a national security risk. These New York City residents expressed their concern about the court's decision.
A lot of small businesses, even such as myself, like I use it as like a marketing tool. So when people are kind of, I think, like restricted to express or share whatever they want, that's when oftentimes, like, people want to speak up against it.
Honestly, it's really bad for us. I know small businesses that they grew up thanks to TikTok, right? And this ban is going to affect not only, like, small businesses, but big corporations as well, politicians as well, because TikTok is, like, It's a big network with everybody. It's like a community, right? And this affects us, everybody.
Some views from New York there. Emily Baker-White is an investigative reporter with the American business magazine Forbes. She's writing a book at the moment about TikTok, and I asked her how this ban would work practically.
TikTok won't disappear from people's phones on the 19th, but it may well become inoperable. And the reason that I know that and what I look to figure out what this will look like is that TikTok has been banned in other countries and has left the market in other countries. And when it has done that, generally, people will open up their phones, they'll open up TikTok, and instead of seeing their TikTok feeds, they'll see a message from the company. And that message will say something like, TikTok is no longer available in your region, and it will presumably have a link where people can read more. And in the US, if TikTok is still fighting this bill, it may say, you know, call your congressperson and ask them to do X. It may actually contain sort of a call to action there, but the feed will probably not be available as usual come Sunday.
Is it legally possible still for the new president to overturn this ban?
It depends a little bit what you mean by overturn. So the law itself allows for the president of the United States to make a one-time extension of 90 days if he determines that there is progress being made toward a sale. So what the bill actually wanted to do was not ban TikTok, but force ByteDance to sell TikTok to a company without ties to China. ByteDance has said it won't do that. It said that's impossible. And the Chinese government has control over whether such a ban could happen and has said that it would block such a sale. But if the president were to say, progress is being made toward a sale, I'm going to grant this 90-day extension, he could likely do that under the bill. There's a question of statutory interpretation about whether it's too late for him to do that, but he can probably do that. And that would give him time to then either ask Congress to amend the law or repeal the law, or to work out something with ByteDance and the Chinese government to enable a sale.
And very briefly, does it matter that most users of TikTok don't care about security concerns, national security?
That didn't stop Congress from passing the law. So user sentiment is not a directly relevant thing here. Congress has passed the law. The law is the law. And sort of someone has to change that from a legal perspective or not.
Emily Baker-White, reporter with the US business magazine Forbes. Now, a lot of Americans, of course, make a living via TikTok. They include Naomi Hartz, who makes videos about self-love and body confidence. She's got more than 1 million followers on the platform, and she told me how things worked.
I post content and you can get money from the creator fund, but most of my income comes from brand deals because of the platform I've built on TikTok. My message has definitely been about self-love and body positivity and comedy and just moving through life in a way that's not too serious.
And you must be worried about that platform disappearing then.
100%. I think it's definitely something that makes me nervous. It's the closest we've been to a ban since a ban ever came in the picture 2 or 3 years ago. But I've definitely been focusing on diversifying my platforms.
So you sort of saw this coming?
You know, I was cautiously optimistic. I've been to DC with TikTok twice now to fight the ban. And so I was always cautiously optimistic about this going the other way. But I think right now, more than ever, I'm definitely the most nervous I've been.
But you're going to spread onto other platforms and they exist? The equivalent exists?
It's hard because TikTok is such a rare platform, I feel. It just came out of nowhere and became something so massive that so many people utilize every day. And so I don't feel like there will ever be another platform in my lifetime that will equate to this app. However, there are other platforms that have stood the test of time, like YouTube, like Instagram, that you can move over and hopefully start to do content there as well.
What do you like particularly about TikTok? What will you miss?
What I loved about TikTok is that you didn't have to be someone in the spotlight to create a platform. You could have been anyone off the street and just picked up your phone and made content and became something just because you had something to say, versus other apps where you had to have been someone to have a following. And so I think I will just miss the authenticity of TikTok.
Are you not worried at all that the Chinese are harvesting your data?
Not at all. I think other platforms are also taking our data. You know, I get spam phone calls all the time. And for me, I'm just like, I think it would be best to have something for all platforms to make sure they're all being checked versus just coming for one specific app.
The internet world is a mystery for those who are not pulling the strings, surely. You don't really know what's going on.
100%. I think we're in a place where no one really knows. And I guess maybe that's where the fear comes from. But I definitely know that on all the platforms I've been on, the most comfortable I've been and the most safe I've felt has been on TikTok.
You've heard the Supreme Court decision. Is that it for you? Do you have any faith that it'll be overturned, that President Trump's love for TikTok will win the day? Newfound love, I should say.
You know, definitely newfound love, definitely very interesting. It's all feeling like a game of chess to me. I'm moving cautiously and definitely have a little bit of optimism. However, I'm definitely focusing as a creator who makes income on these platforms, diversifying my platforms and using other platforms I have to really just continue what I've built.
That was Naomi Hartz, who's a content producer on TikTok in the US. And we turn to Kenya now and the tragic case of a baby called Samantha Pendo, who was caught up in post-election violence in Kenya back in 2017. She was badly injured during a police operation to quell opposition protests, and she later died. 12 police officers are now facing charges of murder, as well as other allegations of torture and rape during those raids. But the baby Pendo case has repeatedly been delayed. From Kisumu, Anne Soy reports.
It is a scar that will never fade away.
The pain of losing a much-awaited child. Samantha Pendo was born after her parents suffered 3 miscarriages. Her father, Joseph Abanja, says she bore a striking resemblance to his mother.
That little girl I named after my mom, and they took her away from me.
A calm child who loved to chuckle. But at only 6 months, tragedy struck. It was election season, August 2017. Then-President Uhuru Kenyatta was seeking re-election.
I wish to declare Honorable Uhuru Kenyatta as president-elect.
He was declared winner in a disputed poll. The announcement triggered protests in the opposition strongholds, including Nyalenda informal settlement, where Pendo's family lived. The state deployed police to quell the riots, and their actions that night forever changed the family. They heard the police break down their neighbors' doors and hit them with clubs. When the officers got to theirs, they threw a tear gas canister inside the house, forcing the family to come out. Lensa Acheng says her baby was suffocating.
They went ahead, beating me while holding my daughter. What was coming outside her mouth? It was foam. After seeing that, I had to go and rescue his dad because he was being beaten.
That's when I hear my wife shouting, Jose, they have killed our daughter. When I hold my daughter, I ask them, why are you doing this?
They say the officers retreated after they realized the baby had been severely injured. A neighbor took Pendo and her mother to hospital.
And I hoped that they were going to save my daughter, having hopes for 3 days. And that is the end. She breathed her last. That is the scene that I'll never forget.
The post-mortem found that Pendo suffered severe head injuries, including a cracked skull.
In Nyalenda Estate in Kisumu County on the 9th.
A public inquest and further investigations found the police culpable.
Are found liable for the death of the deceased baby Samantha Pendo.
But the quest for justice has been delayed. Willie Sotieno is one of the lawyers representing victims of the 2017 post-election violence.
The state is no longer interested in prosecuting the perpetrators.
What other options do you have?
We will pursue private prosecutions. If we cannot get any progress in Kenya, we have now an opportunity to seek justice at the International Criminal Court.
Rights groups agree. Irungu Houghton is Amnesty Kenya's executive director.
It should have not taken 7 years for the case to start. It shouldn't have taken 2 or 3 years for plea taking, which is the stage that we're at the moment. They have deferred the case on 2 separate occasions, which has concerned not just Amnesty International, but the Law Society of Kenya and the International Justice Mission.
The BBC wrote to the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions for comment, but it responded that it was unable to handle the request due to unstated and foreseen challenges. Each time their quest for justice stalls, Joseph says it rekindles the pain of losing his child in the hands of the state.
I remember a lot. She was my everything. We need to have that justice, no matter what.
The father of baby Samantha Pendo speaking to the BBC's Anne Soy in Kenya there. You're listening to the BBC World Service. Live from London, this is NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour, live from the BBC. Russia has sentenced 3 lawyers who defended Alexei Navalny to several years for passing messages from the late opposition leader when he was in prison. The case is part of a big crackdown on dissent during the Ukraine offensive, and it has alarmed human rights groups who fear that Moscow will now ramp up trials, not just against campaigners, but also against the lawyers that represent them. The Kremlin has sought to punish Navalny's associates, even after his unexplained death in an Arctic prison camp last February. So is this targeting of lawyers new? David Herzenhorn is the Russia editor for The Washington Post, also author of a 2023 book profiling Alexei Navalny.
It isn't actually new, but it just shows how committed, if that's the word, the Kremlin is to cracking down on Navalny and his supporters even after his death. Now, these 3 lawyers who were sentenced today were arrested, in fact, while Navalny was still alive, October 2023, at a point when the Kremlin was seeking to cut him off completely from virtually all communication. Obviously, this makes a total sham of the Russian justice system. We know that, in fact, it's impossible for folks to get true justice in Russian courts. But here, they're not even pretending. These are lawyers who were charged with participating in an extremist group, Navalny's organization, the Anti-Corruption Foundation, charged that way with extremism, even though what they were doing, obviously, was just their jobs, acting as his legal representation. And the problem was they were his conduit to the outside world. Now, the more relevant point is that this sentencing happened on January 17th, the anniversary of Navalny's return to Russia and his arrest after he had recovered from a poisoning attack. Remember, he was almost killed in Siberia, eventually flown for medical help in Germany, recovered from that poisoning attack, and then fearlessly or crazily or both went back to Russia, where he was immediately arrested at the airport.
Clearly, the Kremlin still thinks that Navalny's legacy is a threat.
There's no question about that. His wife, Yulia, is living outside the country in exile, but her arrest has also been ordered. 2 other lawyers for Navalny are out of the country. They've been charged in absentia. And it's clear that this is a message as we approach the anniversary of his death, February 16th, to anyone who might still support Navalny. They're thinking about going out to visit his grave, about demonstrating that he is still Putin's enemy number one and that there could be repercussions. The other thing we have to keep in mind is because the Russian authorities had undertaken this absurd case against these lawyers, they couldn't just drop it, right? Once Navalny is dead, they couldn't just let it go. That would just reveal the whole charade of this claiming of an extremist organization. And so instead, they followed through prison sentences up to 5.5 years. It's absolutely a travesty and not a surprise, though, coming from Putin's Russia.
And you'd have to be a brave soul to turn out and protest on February the 16th now.
There's no question that folks, and they've done it before, they will come out. There were lawyers who came out in support of these lawyers. There are still very principled people in Russia who are trying to get the word out. But as we know, an unbelievable repression that's been underway. At the Washington Post, we spent much of last year focused on a series called Russia Remastered about the transformation of Russian society since the 2022 invasion of Ukraine. So much focus has been on the horrors of the battlefield, on the wanton destruction of Ukrainian cities. Folks have sometimes missed that Russia has become this extremely repressed, highly militarized society, even in the arts, in the cultural sphere. There is absolute loyalty demanded by the Kremlin.
David Hasenhorn, who is Russia editor for the Washington Post. Finally on the programme, an extraordinary discovery has been made in the latest excavations in the Roman city of Pompeii, buried beneath volcanic rock and ash when Mount Vesuvius erupted 2,000 years ago. Archaeologists have unearthed a beautifully preserved bathhouse inside a luxurious private residence. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, has been given exclusive access to the site. She was shown around by Pompeii archaeologist Dr. Sophie Hay.
We're starting the tour in the hot room, the Calidarium. It's a sort of relatively large room, considering it's a private residence. So there's a basin in front of us. It would be filled with water. They would dip in and get clean. You've got what would have had marble floor, marble on the walls, a beautiful niche as well, with potentially a little hole in to let light in. And you can kind of start imagining the people in this room and the noises, the sort of splashing of water, people discussing, you know, how they're getting clean or the politics of the day. It's very, very evocative of that era.
So you start with the hot room. So you get warm.
Yes.
And then we're going to move through to quite a different space. This is the warm room.
Yes, and underneath our feet there's a whole other level because we've got hot air coming from the furnace room. So this is a suspended floor, and underneath us is what is called a hypocaust system. So it's on little pillars, and so hot air would be underneath us. So it would feel a bit like a sauna, essentially. This is probably where you would, you know, put oil on your skin and have your slave sort of scrape it off with a stridgel.
And we're just going to keep on moving through because it's a sequence of rooms going through a very narrow doorway here.
So this would be the changing room, essentially. And around us we have these huge red panels of wall plaster, but in them you can see these little holes, and they would be the fixtures for a little shelf so you can sit down and take your sandals off and then go in for the bath experience.
The floor's very beautiful as well, little mosaics and larger, is it marble?
It is, all different marbles from all around the Roman Empire, so you can really see the Roman Empire on the floor here.
And Sophie, we're going to cross this pretty threshold into another room, which is absolutely spectacular. Wow.
It is. It's a really magical space. This is basically the frigidarium of the bath complex.
So it's like a plunge pool almost.
Exactly that. Deep enough to plunge into, but there's also a little ledge so that the guests who were invited by the owner could come and sit and on a hot day dangle their legs in the cold water and cool off. Bathhouses in Pompeii in a private residence are really rare. We only know of a handful, and so for one to be on this scale must mean the owner is super rich. This is one of the very top of the elite. He had power, he had money, and wanted to show it off to clients and impress people.
Yeah, power, money, and a private bathhouse.
Indeed.
That was our science editor, Rebecca Morell, reporting from the Roman ruins of Pompeii and rounding off this edition of NewsHour. Thank you very much for listening from the whole team. Bye-bye.
I'm Alex Ritson, and on the Global News Podcast, we're covering the latest in the Middle East, where Israel and Hamas have signed their ceasefire and hostage release agreement, which is due to take effect on Sunday. But until then, the war continues, with Palestinian authorities reporting at least 86 deaths from continued Israeli airstrikes on the territory since the announcement of the truce. We bring you the top stories from BBC News twice a day on weekdays and daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.